When the narcotic farm opened in Lexington, Kentucky in 1935, it was the first U.S. correctional facility dedicated to helping incarcerated addicts overcome drug addiction. The institution also housed drug abusers who'd never been arrested, who just simply shown up at the prison's doors seeking help. I'm being joined now by two authors of a book about the facility, J.P. Olson, a writer and documentary filmmaker, who's in our studio, and Nancy Campbell, an associate professor of science and technology at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, who's written two earlier books on drug addiction. She joins us by phone. The book called The Narcotic Farm is published by Abrams, and I'm pleased that it brings J.P. Olson and Nancy Campbell to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
J.P., roughly what percentage of the patients at the narcotic farm on any given day were prisoners? How many were there because they checked themselves in for treatment?
You know, over the life of the institution, I'd say about one-third of the people who were in the institution were volunteers who checked themselves in, and about two-thirds were federal prisoners.
And a lot of them were jazz musicians. I don't know what percentage were, but when you look over the list of people who were there, Chet Baker, Elvin Jones, Stan Levy, Jackie McLean, Red Rodney, Sonny Rollins, I mean, that's an extraordinary group.
You know, in the course of doing research on the book and also the documentary, I spoke with a jazz musician by the name of Frank Foster, and I remember him telling me it wasn't just dozens of great musicians that were in that institution, but literally hundreds of great jazz musicians were in that institution.
Did many of them check themselves in?
Many of them did, yes. Tad Dameron is one exception that we know about. He was there for a couple of years and, in fact, charted a couple of records and the notations taken out of the facility and recorded. So he was conducting a band while he was there.
Nancy, where had drug addicts who'd been convicted of crimes been sent before the narcotic farm was built?
Well, before Lexington opened, what you had were people who were going to federal penitentiaries. So, for instance, the largest prison in the country was in Leavenworth, Kansas, known as the Big Top. And about a third to, you know, beginning to push 40% of those prisoners were drug addicts. And so prison officials began to get concerned that drug addicts were filling up prison beds, basically.
And they didn't want them in their prisons? Or I guess they felt that they shouldn't be mixed with hardened criminals?
Indeed. Well, no, it was more the opposite. They were concerned that the addicts would corrupt the prisoners.
I see. A murderer might turn to drugs.
Indeed.
So whose idea was it to build this prison? It's a 1,000-acre site in rural Kentucky.
It was actually both the Bureau of Prisons and the U.S. Public Health Service got together. The Bureau of Prisons concerned about prison overcrowding, which had begun to happen in the mid to late 1920s. Turned to the Public Health Service and said, couldn't you help us do something with these addicts? And the Public Health Service didn't know very much about addicts at the time, but were led actually by the U.S. Congress to begin a massive treatment and rehabilitation program as a result of legislation in 1929.
That's before the Depression, but the building actually opened 1935?
Yeah.
Was it a WPA project in any way, or did it precede that that plan, that program?
It was concurrent.
Mm-hmm.
The legislation mandated the building of the U.S. narcotic farms. It didn't mandate the site. There was an actual competition for the site itself, and the Lexington Board of Commerce came out ahead on that and was able to site the narcotic farm a few miles outside of town.
J.P., you've said that the narco farm's goals were audacious. What were the goals, and in what way were they audacious?
Well, I think when the institution was open, there was this feeling that all sorts of problems could be solved through science, and there had been some evidence to support that. Things like pellagra had been eliminated, which we don't even think about today, but you know, that affected large numbers of people, and there were other things that were being you know, developed in terms of you know, the public health. And so the feeling was, if you took a person out of their environment and you cleaned them up and you taught them a trade, then they would go back rehabilitated, and this problem would go away. That's really what they believed when it opened.
But they were putting them into a farm.
Yes.
They're taking a lot of city folks and bringing them into a farm. Did they think that It would make them into productive citizens.
You know, it's a powerful, there's a powerful mythology at work in American culture about this idea, and it continues today that, you know, the country is healthier, the air is going to be better, you're going to be a better person by being outside, and that sort of powerful myth was certainly part of it. It's part of the progressive era way of thinking.
Well, often there are programs. Work programs in prisons that are intended to give people a trade after they leave. But for the jazz musicians, I can't imagine working as carpenters or auto mechanics or in the print shop really would have much meaning. Did any of the musicians you spoke to suggest that it had been helpful?
Well, I can say that at certain periods when the institution was trying to figure out ways to reach patients because clearly farm work was not cutting it, they opened up the institution for jazz musicians to practice their trade as well, and so people were allowed to practice 5-6 hours a day. They put on shows, so I think there was this real attempt at trying to find out, well, what is it that you liked before you got into drugs, and how can you get back on track?
And did it matter whether you had been arrested or whether you had gone out of your own volition? Did you have to work nonetheless?
Yes. In fact, people would arrive at the institution, some of them as volunteers, thinking, well, I'm going to this rehab center, and I guess there's some prison component, and they would find themselves smack dab in the middle of a prison next to someone doing 20 years.
Although it quickly became known as a country club prison because it was built with tennis and basketball courts,
sure.
Bowling alleys. There were pool tables, ping pong tables, a golf course.
Golf course, yeah. I mean, I have to say that over the course of working on in the book and the documentary and interviewing people who had been patients there, they all said the same thing. They said, you know, if you're going to do time, this is a great place to do time. And I didn't hear anyone ever say that the staff was in any way brutal. And these are people who had gone in and out of all sorts of environments, and they knew what was a good prison and what was not.
But it is rather progressive for the time.
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, an institution
even
like
today,
that,
some people would complain, and they got good food
Well. This institution would not exist today. And yes, everyone said, including William Burroughs, that the food was great.
William Burroughs, we should point out, was another one of the people who went there. Did he include it in his book, Junkie?
He did. There's 3 or 4 pages of talking about his experiences there, and they scan with everything that I heard from other people. The food was good. The doctors were solicitous, and there was just a general sense that this was a large institution that was just packed with people who had a similar life experience, similar drug problems.
Nancy, wasn't part of the Narcotic Farm's mission to figure out why some people became addicted to drugs and others can take drugs without becoming addicted?
Yes. They were very interested in what was the difference between an addict and a non-addict. Were there differences in disposition, in character, moral character, IQ, metabolism? They were very interested in trying to figure that out, in part because they were very focused on whether they could develop a cure for addiction.
And they had an addiction research center that was staffed by doctors and scientists. How did the prisoners get involved in that?
Well, the goals of the Addiction Research Center were twofold. There was the effort to find a cure, but there was also the effort to find a drug that would have the beneficial effects of morphine, but not the downside of addiction. And so what they began to do, and the effort actually began in the 1920s, even before the opening of the Narcotic Farm, but once the farm was opened, they realized that here were people who were experienced addicts, who knew what the subjective effects of drugs were like, who could compare an unknown compound to something like heroin or morphine, and they could rate it. They could say, well, it gives you a better rush, or it's basically inert. And so they began to, and this happened only for prisoners, not for volunteers. Volunteers could not be part of the research program. And only a small part of the number of the prisoners, maybe in the hundreds, were ever actually part of the experimentation at the Narcotic Farm. But what they were doing was trying to learn about the basic mechanisms of addiction, but also find out whether any of the drugs that the pharmaceutical companies were flooding the market with after World War II would work as painkillers, but not be addictive.
And they never came up with one, did they?
Well, I don't think we have found that holy grail even today. If you're looking for a drug that has the pain-killing effects, the beneficial effects, but is not habit forming, is not addictive. That's been an elusive goal.
Didn't some of the research even involve scientists re-addicting patients who'd gotten clean so that they could study them while they were dependent on the drugs, and then watch them go through withdrawal?
Right. Much of the research was precisely that. You take somebody who's abstinent. Most of the federal prisoners, once they got to Lexington, were already off the drug because they had been in other federal institutions.
So this was a kind of a rehab facility.
Right. So here you have that. The major contradiction of the narcotic farm is that you have people who are supposedly in rehabilitation and supposedly in treatment, but some of them, a small number of them, volunteer to participate in scientific experiments, and the only way that you can tell whether a new unknown compound is going to pose a public health problem is basically to give it to human beings and see what happens. And so they were in the practice of re-addicting former addicts. They actually called them post-addicts, and letting them become re-addicted to morphine, then taking them off that drug and seeing whether or not they go into withdrawal. And if they do go, you know, obviously they go into withdrawal, they administer the new compound to see whether or not it arrests the symptoms of withdrawal. If it does, then it's obviously a candidate drug. It's like morphine. It's like methadone. It's like heroin. And so that's exactly what they were doing. They were using, you can use the term human guinea pigs to describe that process.
Well, they also gave them LSD, and we'll get into that in a moment. My guests are Nancy D. Campbell, associate professor at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, J.P. Olson, a documentary filmmaker and journalist. They are two of the three authors of a book, along with Luke Walden, also a documentary filmmaker, book called The Narcotic Farm, The Rise and Fall of America's First Prison for Drug Addicts, published by Abrams. And we have a caller on the line who says he spent some time at Lexington. Marty from Jackson Heights. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Morty, I'm sorry. Hi, Morty.
Yes, I'm sorry. I just switched over to my hardwired phone. Yes, hello.
Is this bringing back memories, Morty?
Well, yes. It made me think about how ineffective my stay there was. I thought I had failed to kick heroin several times, and I heard that Barney Ross was there. And
the boxer.
Other well-known people were there, and so I was encouraged to go there. And I thought by spending 5 months drug-free, weightlifting, eating well, and reading and everything, that I would be okay. But once I got out, I didn't really change, as I learned what that was the problem in Phoenix House, where I was one of the first residents there in 1960, late 66, early 67.
What you're saying is that they gave you all these nice, healthy things to do, but they didn't prepare you psychologically for going back into the environment that in which you'd become addicted in the first place?
Yes. Went to
Did you go to psychotherapy?
Yes, they had a psychotherapy group, but it was sort of an old style one where hardly any. There was a leader who was a professional, but other people didn't really say much and weren't encouraged to say much when you talked, and if you said something, the psychiatrist would say, "Well, what do you think?" You know, that type of thing. And I didn't feel like I was getting anywhere with that. Of course, the encounter groups at Phoenix House really got, worked well.
So you think Phoenix House was more effective?
Oh, yes. Yes.
And when were you at Lexington?
Pardon?
When were you at Lexington?
63, 64, mm-hmm. 5 months.
Well, thank you so much for calling us.
Well, thank you.
You were a volunteer, so you didn't go through any of the drug experiments.
Well, that's another thing. I tried to volunteer when I heard that, I could get free heroin. You know, it showed how committed I was to really being drug-free. I thought, I could volunteer for this program. And luckily, I was rejected.
Thank you so much for calling us, Marty.
Okay, thank you.
Now, why would the people who were not rejected want to even participate in these experiments? I mean, they must have realized that they were human guinea pigs, didn't they, JP?
The sense that I've gotten from all the people that I'd interviewed was that there was a lot of interest in going into that program, and that, you know, essentially, you know, you're talking about people who are often doing long sentences, and they're not there because they want to be. They're there because they have to be. And there was often a feeling, well, you know, if Uncle Sam's going to lock me up, I'm going to get something out of this. And I don't have any intention of stopping, because the moment that I get out, I'm going to go right back to the same street corner. So there was a pretty clear-eyed sense, I think, of what people were getting themselves
into.
Were
they promised shortened sentences?
They would, yeah, they would take time off sentences, and there was also, for about half the life of the institution, there was a drug bank where you would get small doses of heroin at the end of that project, depending on how, you know, that particular program, depending on how long you'd been in it.
Did anyone question whether what was being done was ethical?
Fascinating question, and one that we struggled with throughout the making of the book and the film, was looking at the you know, the idea that you would think this would just be so obvious. But we ran across newspaper story after newspaper story spelling out, major papers, I mean, New York Herald, et cetera, spelling out exactly what they were doing in Lexington. And there was never, to my knowledge, anyone that saw anything wrong with that, because prisoner testing was common, you know, at the time, and there was a feeling that this was for the public good.
Has there been any follow-up? For example, LSD can be quite damaging psychologically for some people. They were giving them LSD without really telling them what they were doing.
There's I'm not sure if that's necessarily the case in terms of not telling them that was going to happen. But one thing that's worth remembering, and this isn't to, you know, to be an apologist for what they were doing, but it's worth remembering in the early 1950s, LSD was akin to something like Prozac. It was seen as this thing could be therapeutically very helpful for people. It was seen by psychiatrists as something that could crack open the subconscious and get to issues. So it was not viewed in the way that it is today in the 1950s. It was seen as a drug that was given by a psychiatrist and that it was fundamentally safe.
But Nancy, wasn't the Addiction Research Center's reputation pretty much ruined by revelations that it had accepted money from the CIA in exchange for help in testing LSD on these unwitting prisoners at the narcotic farm?
Yes, the CIA, through its MKUltra program, did contract with many labs, 80 or so, across the country and also in Canada. Basically, if you were doing research with LSD, the CIA came knocking on your door to see if they could pay you. So between 1953 and 1963, the ARC did accept those kinds of payments. And what they were doing actually in Lexington was different from what they were doing elsewhere. They were doing things like, can we give you a tranquilizer to help you come down from a bad trip? Is there an antidote for LSD? In other words, is there a way that you can kind of buffer whatever's going on for people in LSD? And they were also fascinated with LSD because it was such a novel drug. I mean, these guys had studied a lot of opiates and barbiturates and all kinds of other drugs, but this drug seemed novel. It seemed very interesting to them. So you have to think about who they are as scientists. Their curiosity is really piqued also.
But they didn't see any parallel.
LSD was considered a treatment for alcoholism and possibly one for addiction. And so they were exploring that possibility as well.
So they didn't see any parallels with what had gone on with the Public Health Service researchers in Tuskegee, Alabama, who had continued a study of African-American men infected with syphilis for years after they could have been cured?
Well, not until the summer of 1972. After that, the parallels were drawn. And so it's a very interesting story, because I think I certainly went into this research thinking I had stumbled on another Tuskegee. And so what's interesting about the story that we're trying to tell today is that that isn't the story. That, in fact, what was happening at the Addiction Research Center, which is still in existence today, it's the Intramural Research Program of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, is that it was producing the formative knowledge on opiate addiction, and so it was actually, you know, it's very interesting that you have two research programs basically administered by the Public Health Service that end up having very different effects on subjects and being, I think, that you have to differentiate between the ethics of what was happening at the ARC and the ethics of what was going on in you know, the clearly unethical practices of the Tuskegee study of syphilis and the untreated syphilis in the Negro male.
So J.P. Nancy is suggesting that there were positive outcomes from this research.
I don't think there's any question. I mean, one of the things that drew me to the subject in the first place was that the up until now, at least, the popular description of the institution was quite negative. But if you speak to people who work in addiction science, and we're talking about people who work, you know, leading, you know, medical colleges, et cetera, people who are working in public health, they all, if they're old enough, look to that institution as having been the vanguard for many years for much of what we know today about addiction, for example, using, you know, methadone in detoxification. Buprenorphine was developed there, which is quite quite commonly used now with some success for people who are trying to kick heroin. You know, the understanding that there are triggers in one's behavior, for example, when someone gets out of an institution and goes to Lexington, if they go back to the same neighborhoods with the same friends, et cetera, there are all these overwhelming feelings that they have. A lot of these things were understood and identified through this institution.
That is kind of a Pavlovian component to drug addiction.
That's exactly right. In fact, the researcher who discovered that was quite interested in Pavlov.
And Nancy, we also learned, I guess, what drugs on the market might be dangerous as a result of this research.
Yes,
pharmaceutical
and
companies
more,
draw upon the research?
Yes, absolutely. More often we learned which drugs to control before they went onto the market because, you know, before the 1960s, clinical trials like we have today were not required. And so drug companies could put substances out on the market without having them controlled. And so methadone, you know, or some of the other opiates are good examples of drugs that the ARC would test and basically say not only for domestic drug control, but also the data from the ARC went to the World Health Organization and the United Nations to basically say these drugs should be controlled and these drugs may pose a public health problem, may be dangerous. Warning labels should be put on bottles of barbiturates, for instance. Right, all of those kinds of things arose from the ARC at a time before there was really the kind of consciousness that was necessary to bring clinical trials about in a more common way.
So those are the positives. The negatives are that there was a 90% recidivism rate for people who left the narcotic farm at Lexington. That makes it sound quite ineffective.
It also actually brings up a good point that I think is an interesting conversation with Morty, who called in, and that is that relapse is a serious problem. It's a social problem. It's an individual problem, but it's also a scientific puzzle. And they were trying from the late 30s onward to figure out why do people relapse? Why do people who are very strong-willed and who actually are committed to getting off drugs, why do they go out and relapse almost immediately? The experience that Morty described is actually quite common experience.
And JP, you have about 15 seconds to add something.
Well, I think that you know, treating drug addiction is in some ways akin to treating cancer in the sense that you may get the best treatment available and you still may not make it. And so I think that the expectation that you have this treatment, everything is going to be fine after that is an obsolete idea.
You've also made a film about the narcotic farm?
That's right. The film's actually going to be airing here in New York at noon on Friday on NYC TV 25. So DVR that.
J.P. Olson is a documentary filmmaker. He and Luke Walton both are two of the authors of this book, along with Nancy D. Campbell, associate professor at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. The book, Narcotic Farm, from Abrams. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.